Good evening to everybody. Good evening and welcome aboard flight. You think I'm kidding you. You think I'm joking. That has nothing to do with the fact that I just got off the plane. We used to have classes in Jewish thought and philosophy in school, in yeshiva, and we had affectionately nicknamed them flight school. And hopefully we will stay as grounded as we can, given the fact that our course of study is the Rambam, and for the most part, the Rambam was pretty grounded. But nonetheless, our course of study this year is going to take us on a journey through the 13 principles of faith, as they are known, Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah. We know them from a number of various sources, and we will discuss what those sources are and where they come from and their significance. And essentially, it's a text study. We will be looking at the text both of the Rambam as well as some of the sources that the Rambam used to base his analysis of Jewish philosophy on, and of course discussing and dialoguing all kinds of interesting and fun things through the course of the year. A couple of words of housekeeping before we start. And for that, I'm going to turn the tape off. In order to understand the Rambam, and we're going to be essentially diving into one of the earliest and most important texts that the Rambam wrote, I think it's very important to spend a little bit of time, and that's what I want to do this evening, to back up a little bit and do an overview of who and what the Rambam was. Most of us are familiar with the Rambam from various contexts. We hear about the Rambam, we study the Rambam, we learn the Rambam, we do all kinds of engage with the Rambam in all kinds of different ways. But it's not often that we have really an opportunity to take a step back and try to understand a little bit of who this individual was that was so transformative in Jewish life and in Torah life. I mean, I think learning Torah, Halacha, everything would look dramatically different were it not for the contribution of the Rambam. And so what I wanted to do this evening, if you came in late, please make sure that your name is on the sheet and you learn about our strange sense of calendar, which we'll figure out. So what we're going to do tonight is a little bit of biographical information and background. I'm going to give you a paid commercial for the Rambam. He's not running for office, but nonetheless, I'm going to ask you to pass this around. Were he running for office, I think he would win. So that's my commercial for the Rambam. Sending out a page, which is basically an overview chart of the biography of the Rambam and some information, which we're going to use as a text for this evening. There should be enough for almost everybody, which means that you may have to share. Baruch Hashem, we are more than I anticipated, which is always a good thing. Can somebody please raise their hand if they have the sign-in sheet? It's there, it's coming. It's over there, good. All right, there are two. Please make sure they get around. To begin with, the Rambam was born in 1135 in Cordoba, Spain. Some interesting pieces of biographical information that is not necessarily relevant other than to understand the man. The Rambam was raised by his father. His mother died in childbirth. He was raised by his father, and he lived in Cordoba, Spain, between the years of 1135 and 1148. In 1148, Spain was conquered by by a militant group of the Muslim reach through Europe, the Almohades, and the Rambam and his family. Rambam is Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. Their family was essentially forced to leave Cordoba because of the threat of forced conversions. The Muslims essentially gave them a choice. They can either convert to Islam or die by the sword. And they chose, although there's much controversy and much discussion about whether for a period of time they hid and actually openly converted to Islam and then secretly remained as Jews and then ultimately left and reasserted their Judaism at a later time. There's some discussion about it. I'm not going to get into that. If you're interested, that's a subject of study for further research. Did the Rambam and his family for a period of time secretly or openly convert to Islam and then reassert their Judaism? Nonetheless, in 1148, they leave Cordoba and they begin a journey. Their journey takes them southward. Ultimately, they wander through Spain and North Africa for 10 years. They finally settle in Fez, Morocco, in on around 1158 or 1160. It's not clear, but assuming that he gets there in 1158, the Rambam leaves the age of 13, and his journeys finally settle at the age of 23. Those are very significant and very formative years. And as we'll see momentarily when we talk about what the Rambam wrote and when, those years were essentially characterized by traveling by sea, by foot. We all know what traveling does. Short journeys. Imagine essentially 10 years of journey, during which time the Rambam used that time when he was alone with his father to continue his studies. And by the time he emerges at the age of 23 in Fez, Morocco, he is the scholar, the scientist, the halachist, the philosopher that we know him to be. So those formative years of his journeys were essentially the years over which he delved into his studies and studied everything from science and astronomy to medicine and medicine to Jewish law and Jewish philosophy. If you look beneath the chart, you have a quote from the Hebrew, which is a quote from his commentary on the Mishnah, one of the first things that the Rambam wrote. I'm going to go through his writings chronologically in a moment, but one of the earliest things that he wrote was his commentary on the Mishnah, which was essentially published in 1158. The commentary on the Mishnah established the Rambam as one of the preeminent scholars and halachists across the Jewish globe. The end of the commentary on the Mishnah, in the very last paragraph, he writes that this work was written biyot libi tarud leitim krovot bifigei hazman, my heart distracted with the challenges of the time, umash gazar Hashem aleinu min hagalut vehanidud ba'olam mikatzei hashamayim v'ad katzei hashamayim, and that fact that God had decreed upon us to wander the globe from one end to the other. During this time, katafti perushan b'masa'oti b'dvachim, I wrote this commentary on the Mishnah while I was walking and journeying from land to land, bioti al gabe ha'oniot b'yam ha'gadol, and on the seas in the boats that we were traveling in. That was the period of time, it was this description of the time during which he had studied science, astronomy, medicine, Aristotelian philosophy, Jewish law, Talmud, Mishnah, Halacha. And I get tired just listing it.
Too bad he settled down.
Too bad he settled down. That's it. All right, basically, just a quick review of his life. In 1158, he settles in Fez, Morocco. And there he remains until 1165. In 1165, he's forced to leave again, and he makes his major journey all the way to Israel. He arrives in Akko and settles in Yerushalayim. He stays in Israel for a period of approximately 2 years, 1165 to 1166. Situation in Israel in 1165 to 66 was not conducive to Aliyah. The Sochnut had not yet established their Aliyah package and Klita programming. I don't believe he found a Merkaz Klita in which to stay. And so the Rambam was forced once again to leave. And this time he journeys to Egypt. In 1166, he arrives in Egypt, in Fastat and in Cairo, and he stays in Egypt from 1166 until the end of his life in 1204. During this period of time in Egypt, in 1166, he begins his professional career as a doctor. The Rambam did not take a penny of communal funds for his position as a rabbi and rabbinic authority. He made his career professionally from his service as a doctor. And we'll see what kind of a doctor he was in a moment. Whereas his work as a Jewish philosopher and a Jewish halachist and authority in Jewish law was his volunteer time in his spare time. In 1174, at the age of 39, he was appointed the court physician to the Sultan of Egypt, and a post he maintained for the remainder of his life. And at the same time, he was also appointed essentially to be the spiritual leader of the Jewish community in Egypt, and as I said, for that he did as a volunteer. Piece of unknown or lesser known trivia: he was so famed a physician, besides the halachist issues, he was so famed as a physician that Richard the Lionhearted, while fighting the Crusades, invited him to become his personal physician, a post which he turned down. I guess we could say thank God, but nonetheless, that is how he ended up as the court physician of the Sultan of Egypt. During this period of time, he writes a number of works in science, in philosophy, and most importantly for our purposes, in Jewish studies. You have a little bit of the timeline on the right, left-hand side of the bottom of this chart. The earliest publication that he writes is his commentary on the Mishnah, which was published in 1158 or 1160. His commentary on the Mishnah spans all 60 tractates of the Mishnah. It's a concise commentary on each Mishnah, summarizing the halachic conclusions in the Mishnah based on the totality of the discussions in the Talmud. In other words, what's unique about the commentary in the Mishnah that the Rambam wrote, unlike all previous or contemporary commentaries on the Mishnah, was that it wasn't just a discussion or a commentary on the text of the Mishnah as it is written, but includes the discussion and the conclusions of all of the Talmudic passages for each Mishnah. So you understand, of course, that to do that you have to know, familiarize yourself with, and essentially memorize the entire Talmud in order to be able to write such a commentary. It's also replete with philosophical treatises, which was also a unique contribution of the Rambam to synthesize his approach to Jewish philosophy with his approach to Jewish law. The Rambam, being both a philosopher and a halach and a Talmudist, essentially merges those two worlds in a number of areas. One is perhaps less significant in its creative thinking, and that is Pirkei Avot. In other words, Pirkei Avot is essentially a book of philosophy anyway, so that his commentary on Pirkei Avot would be, which is part of the Mishnah, would be a philosophical work, is not surprising. What's more surprising is his commentary to the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. The 10th chapter to Sanhedrin begins the Mishnah that describes the concept of the world to come, Olam Haba. The Rambam utilizes that Mishnah as an opportunity to address all of the fundamental concepts of Jewish philosophy, the world to come, messianism, reward and punishment, prophecy, the nature of prophecy, the nature of belief in God, in creation, all the fundamentals of Jewish thought and philosophy are built into his commentary on the Mishnah that describes the concept of Olam Haba and who is worthy of entering the world to come and who is not. This has become known as... Say it again. Yud Gimel Ikrim. This has become known as the 13 Principles of Faith. It's part of his treatise on the commentary on the Mishnah. It's a philosophical treatise, but it's found inside his commentary on the halachic positions of the Mishnah. It wasn't published as a standalone work, the Rambam's 13 Principles of Faith. It was published as part of that work of the commentary on the Mishnah, and was one of the first things that he published. He subsequently published a commentary on Talmud, unfortunately most of which has been lost. In 1168... 10 years later, he completes the writing of his magnum opus, the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah is undoubtedly the Rambam's greatest work. Let me back up one step before I talk about the Mishneh Torah. At the same time that he publishes his commentary on the Mishnah at the age of 23, he also published two additional works, one on mathematics and science and logic called The Science of Logic, and the second was a treatise on the Hebrew calendar, which is all about astronomy and mathematics built into the calendar, the Hebrew calendar system as we have it today. My plan, Bezrat Hashem, is that sometime this spring is to do a mini course on the Hebrew calendar, and we'll have a chance to get an introduction, a semblance, some inkling of the complexity of the Jewish calendar, of which the Rambam wrote one of the earliest and one of the most fundamental treatises, again published at the age of 23. The Mishneh Torah. What made the Mishneh Torah unique? What is the Mishneh Torah? Also called the Yad HaChazakah, the Great Hand, also known as the Code of Jewish Law. Shulchan Aruch was known by that name. What made the Mishneh Torah unique? What is it? Let's first define what it is. The Mishneh Torah is essentially a codification of every Jewish law as articulated in the Talmud. It's a summary of all of the halachic issues related from the Talmud, every discussion of the Talmud, every halachic position, as well as a summary of all of the halachic material developed from the time of the Talmud up until the Rambam writes and publishes the Mishneh Torah. What makes that unique? There have been many treatises, many codes of Jewish law written through the ages. Actually, most of them post the Rambam, just FYI. It's not clear that he was the first, but certainly the most famous. But what made the Mishneh Torah so unique? You have to understand the Talmud. The Talmud is written as a collection of the records of the discussions in the Beit Midrash surrounding each Mishnah. The Mishnah is a codified, systematic description of Jewish law. The Talmud is anything but systematic and anything but organized. Meaning, the Talmud, each Mishnah, begins a discussion. And the discussions in the Beit Midrash, as discussions in any context of a dialogue amongst many people, can lead to very interesting digressions, and the Talmud is written in the form of stream of consciousness. A subject is raised in a digression, and suddenly the Talmud will digress entirely to address that subject for the next 2-3 pages, and then go on to the next digression, and the next digression, and 14-15 pages later, the Talmud will get back to its original discussion, because it's recorded and written as a collection of discussions in the Beit Midrash. It's one of the reasons why Talmud study is so challenging, because part of the exercise is identifying what those layers of conversation are, both who's speaking to whom, as well as how many layers of generations of conversations, because those layers are actually multi-generational. Now, to take all of the material of the Talmud and to reorganize it into a systematic description of Jewish law, subdivided into 14 categories. If you turn the page over for a moment, the reason why the Mishneh Torah is called the Yad HaChazakah, the great hand, is because the word Yad is in Gematria numerically 14, and there are 14 books to the Mishneh Torah. And they are divided as the book of Sefer Mada, the book of knowledge, Sefer Ahava, book of love, Sefer Zmanim, the book of time or calendar. In other words, it's structured systematically. Under Zmanim, for example, he has the laws of Shabbat and the laws of Pesach and the laws of holidays and the laws of Sukkot and the laws of Megillah, etc. Under Mada, he has the laws of the foundations of the Torah and the laws of the study of Torah and the prohibition of idolatry. Under Ahava, love, he categorizes the laws of prayer and the laws of Kriyat Shema, etc. Each category subdivided into sections, subdivided into chapters, subdivided into halachot. All 14 in a structured sequence, from basic religious, philosophical, psychological concepts to the routine of daily life, to the Jewish calendar, to the laws of marital life, various religious practices, and finally civil criminal law, and ultimately ending with the laws of kingship and nationality. It has been said that the Rambam wrote the code of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah, to be the constitution for a newly created Jewish state at the time of the coming of the Mashiach, which is why it ends with the laws of the kings and the laws of wars. Now, to do this, you had to take a text essentially the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica, commit it completely to memory, then rejuggle every passage and every comment in the entire text, and requote them systematically and structured in these 14 books, in the thousands upon thousands of halachot that are pertaining in the Rambam, and to do this without the aid of a mechanical computer or an electronic computer. He had his own form of computer. It was called his mind. But that's how the Rambam thought. That's the systematic way in which the Rambam looked at the text and the totality of Jewish law. He saw it systematically and he organized it systematically. And of course, it's all committed to memory, and all of this by the age of 45. 14 books over 1,000 chapters long. A scholar once wrote, and I want to give you a brief quote. It's a book called The World of Moses Maimonides. It says, "The Mishneh Torah is a great work of rabbinic scholarship, not only because of the width of its learning, its penetration and integrity, but for its stylistic beauty, its clarity of thought and diction. It is the greatest contribution to Jewish jurisprudence, not only by reason of its practical advantage, but because of its systematic orderliness. Besides its many other qualities, it is logical, well-proportioned, arranged, and that which gave Maimonides' compendium its greatest influence and distinction. Every chapter is a model of clarity, every paragraph and statement a lesson in brevity and precision." Oh, and by the way, in so doing, he had to translate the Talmud from Aramaic to Hebrew, because the Talmud is written in Aramaic, and the Mishneh Torah is written entirely in Hebrew. His final work, of course, was was the Mara Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, which was published towards the end of his life, and for some reason I don't have the year here. Excuse me?
11, 8, 7.
The Mishneh Torah? Oh, sorry. Sorry, the guide to the... Sorry, it's in the right-hand column. In the right-hand column, he has his... I have his philosophical works. His philosophical works, number one, is a treatise which he wrote very early called Treatise on Logic, or Milot Higayon. And then in 1187, he publishes his Guide to the Perplexed. His Guide to the Perplexed is a book of Jewish philosophy, purely philosophy. It's not halachic in any in its nature. It's philosophical in nature. It starts essentially, and I am not a study of Aristotle. I know very little Aristotle, but one of the issues related to the Rambam's philosophical works is comparison to and contrast with Aristotle. He was a student of Aristotle. He followed many of Aristotle's language, although he modifies significantly both the conclusions and the methodology of Aristotle. That's a subject of academic study into itself, the comparison between the Rambam's philosophical works and that of Aristotle. I'm not going to go into it here, and it's not really going to be the subject of our course of study in the Kari Emunah, because I don't think it's necessary. The Rambam wrote his Ikari Emunah at the age of 23, and he wrote it as part of a treatise which he meant for every Jew to read and study. He wrote his Guide to the Perplexed, or his Moreh Nevuchim, specifically, it says, for a particular student who needed it. And he says at the beginning that you really only need to study the Moreh Nevuchim if so inclined, if you need this kind of treatise. So he clearly distinguished between that component of philosophy which he incorporated into the global, popular, halachic positions that he felt every Jew should know, versus the philosophical works of the Moreh Nevuchim, which he felt were unnecessary for an understanding or comprehension of Jewish law. Briefly, I want to touch on his third identity. Halachic Talmudist, philosopher. His third identity, of course, is that of a physician. Scientist, astronomer. Science in those days generally merged. It was essentially one field, science and astronomy and medicine. They don't become subdivided into different fields of study until much later. But he certainly was a scientist, and his approach to science and his approach to medicine is characterized by a rational... was characterized by an approach to science characterized by an embrace of the rational, an attempt to try to remove the irrational and the superstitious from the world of science and embrace it from the world of the rational thinking, as he approached every other component of Jewish life. He has a number of medical writings published between 1190 and 1204, some of which we still have today. This is really out of my field. There are a number of books written about the Rambam's medical writings. The world expert in the field of the Rambam's medical literature is Dr. Fred Rosner. He's actually translated much of the original of the medical writings and written commentaries on them. There are 10 works of the Rambam in medicine that are still available or accessible today, and they are listed on the bottom of this second page: extracts from Galen, Art of Cure, commentary on the aphorisms of Hippocrates, medical aphorisms of Moses called Pirkei Moshe, treatise on hemorrhoids, a treatise on sexual intercourse, a treatise on asthma, a treatise on poison and their antidotes, a guide to good health in 1198, a discourse on the explanation of fits and coincidences, and a glossary of drug names. Now, I once culled from an article written by Dr. Rosner an interesting list of some of the contributions to medical science that the Rambam innovated. It's completely irrelevant to our course of study, but it's fascinating to me. So I'm going to give you that list. I don't have it printed, so you'll bear with me. But these are, according to the literature, these are the some of the scientific breakthroughs that Maimonides is attributed with as having innovated. Breaking medicine down into three categories: preventative, curative, and convalescent. Advocating regular exercise, good diet, fewer tensions, physical and mental hygiene, fresh air and sunshine. He advised people to get out of the cramped and unsanitary cities into open countryside. In his Regimen Sanitatus, which I just mentioned, he recommends that towns and houses be built to provide the populace with plenty of sunshine and air. He is the only medieval physician to recognize the nature of diabetes and its connection with sugar. Equally ahead of his time were his discoveries regarding cancer, recognizing that it has a greater chance of being cured if treated early. The first to recommend cutting off and sucking blood for a snake bite. The first to describe hydrophobia. And the first to discover that the snake's venom lies between its teeth, a fact not otherwise known until 400 years later in 1664. An Arab poet once wrote of the Rambam the following verse, or the following song. He wrote, Galen's art heals only the body, but Abu Amram's the body and soul. He could heal with his wisdom the sickness of ignorance. If the moon would submit to his art, he would deliver her of her spots, and at the time of the full moon, save her from her waning. All of this from a man who spent the first 30 years of his life wandering, fleeing, and without any formal education of any kind, relying solely on his father to teach him whatever his father could, as well as texts which he read, translated, because much of his work was in translating medical texts, and the last 40 years of his life practicing full-time medicine, full-time rabbinics, full-time writer, and full-time scholar for World Jewry, because he wrote during this period of time over 600 responsa from across the globe. I get tired just thinking about half that list. I want to share with you in our conclusion of this section of the introduction what has become quite famous by now, but nonetheless still relevant, a letter that the Rambam writes to a friend of his, a French rabbi by the name of Shmuel Ibn Tibbon, in 1199. He writes this because Ibn Tibbon wants to come and visit him, and the Rambam wrote him a letter essentially saying to him, don't bother, because you could come, I won't have any time to give you. So therefore, 6 years before his death, this is essentially the Rambam's daily routine. God knows that in order to write this to you, I have escaped to a... You have it? It's the next page. The back page of your source of the booklet. God knows that in order to write this to you, I have escaped to a secluded spot where people would not think to find me, sometimes leaning for support against the wall, sometimes lying down because of my excessive weakness and fatigue. But with respect to your wish to come here to me, I cannot but say how greatly your visit would delight me, for I truly long to commune with you and would anticipate our meeting with even greater joy than you. Yet I must advise you not to expose yourself to the perils of the voyage, for beyond seeing me and my doing all I could to honor you, you would not derive any advantage from your visit. Do not expect to be able to confer with me on any scientific subject for even 1 hour, either by day or by night, for the following is my daily occupation. I dwell at Fustat, and the Sultan resides at Cairo. These two places are 2 Sabbaths day's journey, about 1.5 miles, distant from each other. My duties to the Sultan are very heavy. I am obliged to visit him every day, early in the morning, and when he or any of his children or concubines are indisposed, I cannot leave Cairo, but must stay during most of the day in the palace. It also frequently happens that one or two of the officers fall sick, and I must attend to their healing. Hence, as a rule, every day, early in the morning, I go to Cairo, and even if nothing unusual happens there, I do not return to Fostat until the afternoon. Then, I am famished, but I find the antechambers filled with people, both Jews and Gentiles, nobles and common people, judges and policemen, friends and enemies, a mixed multitude who await the time of my return. I dismount from my animal, wash my hands, go forth to my patients, and entreat them to bear with me while I partake of some light refreshment, the only meal I eat in 24 hours. Then I go to attend to my patients and write prescriptions and directions for their ailments. Patients go in and out until nightfall, and sometimes, I solemnly assure you, until 2 hours and more into the night. I converse with them and prescribe for them even while lying down from sheer fatigue. When night falls, I am so exhausted I can hardly speak. In consequence of this, no Israelite can converse with me or befriend me on religious or community matters except on the Sabbath. On that day, the whole congregation, or at least the majority, comes to me after the morning service when I instruct them as to their proceedings during the whole week. We study together a little until noon when they depart. Some of them return and read with me after the afternoon services until the evening prayer. In this manner I spend the days. I have here related to you only a part of what you would see if you were to visit me. Every time I start to complain about my schedule, I reread the Rambam's letter, and then I still complain, but at least I can tell myself I have nothing to complain about. And this is just the schematic background of a man whose mind and understanding and grasp of Jewish philosophy, Torah, Halacha, Talmud, Mishnah, science, astronomy, every matter of intellectual endeavor possible within the gamut of the Jewish world was at his fingertips. And on top of all of that, there were many of the political challenges that faced his time and his community. The Karaites, for example, which were a sect within in the Jewish community in Egypt who essentially embraced the written law but abandoned or rejected the oral law. And the Rambam spent much of his time and energy, as well as his writings, fighting the polemic against the Karaites. My father has a thesis, or a chiddush, in which he says that if you look through the Mishnah Torah, built into the halachic positions of the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam almost always quotes a verse to support virtually every halachic position he takes. Most of the time, those verses are the textual sources that the Talmud uses. Often, they are not. Often, the Talmud will conclude its discussion with the halachic position, and the Rambam will find a verse in the text of the Torah or the Navi that the Talmud doesn't quote, and include it in the Mishnah Torah. And one of the theories my father ascribes to as to why he does that is because that's part of his polemic against the Karaites, which was to anchor every halacha in Torah Shebaal Peh, in the oral Torah, with its parallel anchor in the Torah Shebichtav, in the written Torah, as part of that ongoing polemic against a sect within the community that was embracing only the written Torah and rejecting in total the oral Torah. So there are so many facets to the Rambam's life. Major treatises that he wrote to the Jewish community of Yemen, who were also faced with the issue of forced conversions and the issue of Islam, as well as communities facing the Crusaders and in Christian Europe. These are the challenges of the time in which he lived and the time in which he wrote so prolifically and so profoundly. That's the background, to give us a sense of who it is that we are learning about and whose philosophical works we are going to be touching upon or studying in brief. Are there questions on this introduction before we start our study of the actual material itself?
Was his discipline as sort of a Renaissance man, his father this particular orientation in that teaching, or was it a communal approach to have sort of that covered modest type of approach?
Was his, let me repeat the question for the benefit of all. The question is, was his, and you used the term Renaissance man, I think that's a very appropriate description of the Rambam. Was that an approach that he learned from his father, or was that an approach that was essentially indicative or contemporary to the time and place in which he lived? And the answer is a little bit of both. He certainly learned it from his father, because he was taught virtually everything in private communion with his father in the travels that they had for the during the journey from Cordoba to Fez during that initial 10, 12 years that they were journeying and studying together, the age of 13 to 23. And so certainly I think his father had the most significant influence over his life. But he came from a Sephardic tradition and a part of the Sephardic world which was in its nature more open and more embracing of culture around them and more aware of society around them than were their Ashkenazic counterparts at the same period of time. In other words, part of it is also a function of where he came from. The same scholars in other parts of Ashkenazic Jewry would have not necessarily have had the same approach to the breadth of scholarship outside of the realm of Torah. And of course, that was one of the reasons why the Rambam was so controversial in his time, both for his study of philosophy and Aristotle, as well as the study of science and less so science, more the Aristotelian piece of it. The study of science was very common in Jewish life since the days of the Talmud. I once gave a talk, this is a piece of it, but I once gave a talk on... did some research on all of the Jewish philosophers who were also doctors. All the halachists that we know that were also medical practitioners in essentially through the ages, from the time of the Talmud up through modern times, but certainly focusing primarily on the Middle Ages. And you'd be surprised. We know of the Rambam. But we also know that there were others. The Ramban, Nachmanides, was a physician. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Kuzari, was a physician. There were many, because science and astronomy and knowledge was all integrated. What was rejected by many was the study of philosophy per se, particularly Aristotle, and the Rambam's synthesis there put him into a different category, and that created a controversy surrounding his works. Famous story of the communities which, after the publication of the Mishnah Torah, after the publication of the Moreh Nevuchim, had public book burnings of the Rambam's Yad HaChazaka because of the controversy surrounding it. But that's... I know very little about the details there, but other than that. Any other questions on the introduction?
Do we know anything about his father? Is his father knowledgeable in all these areas?
I would have to assume that he was, because he studied and he learned everything from his father. He writes that in a number of places. I don't know how much we know about his father. Already I'd have to ask the historians and the academics. I don't know. I know that he has a son known who takes over his position. His name was Avraham. He has a commentary called maybe Avraham ben Arambam. It's a parish on the Torah, as well as a book on philosophy. But he never achieved the fame, anywhere close to the fame that the Rambam achieved. Any other questions? All right, let's go back to the main subject of this class, which is the Rambam's 13 Principles of Faith. As I said, for this I'm going to give out our next set of pages. These I'll ask you to bring back over the next couple of weeks because we will need them. This is our source page. The Rambam in his commentary on the Mishnah, as I said, in the Mishnah on the beginning of the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin, writes the following. First of all, the Mishnah. The Mishnah I put as many of the sources I could find on the source page. The one I did not is the Mishnah, so you'll bear with me. Mishnah in beginning of the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin begins as follows. This is not on your source page, so just listen carefully. Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek le'olam haba. Every Israelite has a share in the world to come. As it says, Ve'amech kulam tzadikim le'olam yirshu aretz netzer mata'ay maseyadai lihitpa'er. Your people are all righteous. They shall all inherit the land forever. They are the branch of my planting, my handiwork, in which to take pride. Mishnah starts with the declaration, every Israelite has a share in the world to come. Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek le'olam haba. The next line of the Mishnah says, Elu she'en lehem chelek le'olam haba. With the exception of the following three. The following three categories of people don't have a share in the world to come. And they are one who says the Torah is not from heaven, the one who says there's no Tchiyat HaMetim, the third one, there's no resurrection of the dead, and the third one is Entar Min HaShemayim and the Apikores. Epicurean Apikores. The Rambam is now faced with a challenge. And to explain this Mishnah, he has to explain four things. Namely, excuse me? First, he has to explain the concept of Olam Haba. What is Olam Haba? Second, he has to explain what happens if you don't go to Olam Haba? Now he has to explain five things, because I wasn't counting that. Okay? Second is, what happens if you don't go to Olam Haba? Third, what is the resurrection of the dead? Fourth,
what does
Torah Min HaShemayim mean? What is Torah from heaven? What does that refer to? What is Torah? What is Torah from heaven? Fifthly, what's an Apikores? So now the Rambam is faced with a challenge. To explain this Mishnah, he has to explain fundamental concepts in Jewish thought and philosophy. And that leads him to the description of 13 principles that define the fundamental concepts that are necessary both to understand this Mishnah as well as to understand the broad spectrum of Jewish life. What is Jewish life and Jewish law all about? Now this introduction, this is called an introduction to Perek Chelek. It's part of the commentary on the Mishnah. It's his introduction to this chapter. So before he gets to explain the Mishnah, he explains all the concepts. He has an introduction to the introduction as well. He has an introduction to the 13 principles of faith, which is far longer than the actual 13 principles themselves. I will show you as we go through the course, I will show you excerpts from that introduction. It's available in English if you want to sit down and read it through. It's really a fascinating study. He talks about different types of attitudes towards midrashic material and homiletic material of the sages and various methodologies of how to understand our sages' writings, from those who take them literally to those who take them allegorically. He has a whole discussion about why it's so important to study this material. And ultimately, he then says, I found it necessary at this point in time to define the fundamental principles upon which Judaism is based, these 13 principles, at the conclusion of which he says, those who embrace and accept and understand these 13 principles are part of that category that the Mishnah says every Israelite has a share in the world to come. Says the Rambam, that's true if you embrace and accept the 13 principles of faith. If you don't, the Rambam understood the next line in the Mishnah, the three exceptions, as essentially embracing the three exceptions being the denial of any of these 13 principles or articles of faith that define the fundamentals of Jewish life. And that's how the 13 principles of faith end up in the Rambam's commentary on this Mishnah.
So you're saying the 13 all stem from these three?
Correct. In the Rambam's way of explaining this Mishnah, all these 13 are essentially various themes of understanding in this, either in those three or assumed by those three. And we'll see, one of the things that I want to show you as we go through them through the year is when I first learned or studied the 13 principles of faith, one of the theories, one of the things that I had in my mind was the question is there structure? I didn't bring you a course outline, but Zot Hashem, next week I'll bring you a course outline of all the different topics I hope to cover in this course. But one of the questions that I had when I first approached the material is there structure in this chaos? Is it 13 individual principles that the Rambam puts down on paper and says, okay, principle A, B, and C, 13 different cardinals of faith, or was there some kind of structure to which the Rambam was headed, a goal, a message, a conclusion, and that these 13 principles somehow interconnect with each other to create a building, to create a structure? And that's one of the things that I want to address as we go through this, is to see not only the material itself of the 13 principles and what they are, but how they relate to each other and build one on top of the other, ultimately leading back to that first Mishnah. Most of us are very familiar with the 13 principles of faith. From what source? Yigdal. Most of us know Yigdal. And Yigdal is a summary. It's right. That's why Yigdal, the oddity of Yigdal, is the only song sung in the Jewish liturgy in which we repeat the last sentence, even in those shuls that don't repeat words. Somehow we always repeat that last sentence. Why? Because every song in Jewish life is made up of even number of lines, and melodies are made up to match even number of lines. And unfortunately for us, Yigdal is made up of 13 lines, so we have no choice but to repeat line 13 twice, so we end up with 14 principles of faith, because we believe in the last one twice as much as the other 13. Clearly.
Sydney takes exception to that rule.
I told you, everything's on tape. Be careful what you say. The problem with Yigdal is that the Rambam did not write it. The Rambam wrote his commentary on the Mishnah, and he wrote his paragraphs defining what these 13 principles of faith are. Yigdal was written by a poet sometime in the Middle Ages. Exactly who and when, I'm not sure. But it certainly was not written by the Rambam. Why do I say that? Because at least in one or two lines, I take exception to the interpretation of the 13 principles that appear in the Yigdal. So what I like to do is actually put the Yigdal at the beginning of each section, and as we go through it, just so we have some sense of familiarity as to what these 13 principles are. Yigdal as our jumping point, but of course we will move to the text of the Rambam himself very quickly. I will not go through the Yigdal here with you. We are familiar with it enough as it is, except to review with you briefly as an overview, as our end of our introduction this evening, what are the broad headings of these 13 principles. Yigdal Elokim Chai, great is the living God and praised, Nimtza ve'en et ometziuto, he exists, his existence has no time. The issue of time as it relates to the existence of God is, in my opinion, not part of the first principle, but nonetheless, the first principle is
there is a God.
God. The concept of God, the concept that he exists, we have not defined in this, in, at least in Yigdal, we haven't defined what God is. That we will see in the Rambam himself. And it's interesting that if you're going to talk about God, it doesn't define. And if I were to ask you, what is God? You would tell me, what is God? Not a trick question. Simple. What is God? Who is God? I like the question, what is God, better than who is God. Too philosophical. What a simple definition of what is God?
Creator, sustainer,
supervisor. Also too philosophical. I'll settle with creator for now. But it's interesting, that's not in the Yigdal. It doesn't say that he is the creator. But nonetheless, that's how we normally define the Rambam. We'll come back to that concept a little bit later. Echad v'en yachid, he is one, he is not. V'en yachid ki yichudo, he is one, but there's none like his oneness. Ne'alam, he is hidden, his unity has no end. In sof le'achduto, second reference to time. For some reason, we talked about he has no time. In et, now suddenly he has no end. En lo dmut aguf, en lo guf, he has no form of body, he has no body. Lo na'ruch alav kedushato, he is beyond comparison in his holiness. Principle number one, belief in God, or God exists. Principle number two, the unity of God. Principle number three, in fancy philosophical terms, incorporeality of God. He has no body or form. Kadmon l'chol davar shenivra rishon ve'en reshit l'reshito. He preceded all things that were created. He is first and yet without beginning. He has no time. No beginning and no end. Time. Yeah, there is no time with relation to God. That is the fourth reference, to third reference to time in this introduction. Hino adon olam l'chol notzar yoreg dulato malchuto. He is the Lord, the world, for all things created. He displays his greatness and his majesty. That's the one that I have the greatest issue with. That's not principle number five. Principle number five is, anybody know?
No other gods.
Prohibition of idolatry. How he got from principle the prohibition of idolatry to he is the Lord of the world for all things created, I guess that means there's no other gods other than God, but nonetheless, it was a little bit of a poetic license. Sheref ha-nevuato netano al anshei sgulato v'tifarto. He has granted the bounty of his prophecy to the men of his choice and glory. Principle number six is prophecy. Number seven, Lokam b'Yisrael k'moshe od naviu mabitet tmunato. There is no other like Moses, a prophet who looked upon his image, namely. Principle number seven is the uniqueness of the prophecy of Moshe. Not just the prophecy of Moshe, but the uniqueness of Moshe's prophecy. That's very important for us, and as we will study that principle, we will see it. Number eight, Torat Emet Natan La'amo El Al Yad Nevi'on Eman Beito. God gave a true Torah to his people through his prophet, trusted in all his house. Who is his prophet? Moshe. So principle number eight is, right, God gave a Torah to Moshe, and that relates to the prophecy of Moshe. And number nine, correlated to number eight, of course, is Lo Yachlif Ha'el V'Lo Yamir Dato Li'Olamim L'Zulato. God will not replace or change the Torah that he has given to Moshe through the unique prophecy that Moshe is for any time or for anything else. The fact that it is immutable, that it is eternal. Somewhere along the line between those two, the Rambam spends a great deal of time talking about the fact that the Torah that we have today is in fact the Torah that was given to Moshe, and the importance of the Masoret and the tradition of that Torah being handed down from generation to generation. For some reason, that didn't quite make it into the Yigdal. Sofer v'yodea sitarenu mabit l'sof davar b'kadmato. He sees, he knows our secrets, he sees each thing's end at its very beginning. Principle number 10, God knows all. He is omniscient. Gomel le'ish chesed k'mif'alo noten l'rasha ra k'rish'ato. We have to be careful how we sing it. We often sing that wrong. And we teach our children to sing it wrong. It's not noten l'rasha ra k'rish'ato. It's noten l'rasha ra k'rish'ato. He who repays the evil with an equal amount of iniquity, and who repays the good according to his deeds, the notion of reward and punishment. Schar v'onesh. Number 12, Yishlach l'ketz hayamin mishichenu, liftot mechake ketz yishuato. He will send Mashiach at the end of days to redeem those who await his final victory. Metim yichaye el berov chazdo. God will bring the dead back to life with great love. Baruch ad shem tihilato. May his glorious name be blessed forever and ever. Principle 12 and 13, concept of messianism and the resurrection of the dead. And the relationship between those two, of course, we will address at the end of this course. That is the overview. That's the Yigdal. It defines for us what these 13 principles are. And you can imagine already this will essentially be our course outline. From here, we will digress to various other issues tangentially and substantively related. But we are going to begin, Bezrat Hashem, next week with principle number one. I wanted to use tonight as an introduction. And that's essentially where we will conclude. A reminder of the announcement that